Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an examination of the diplomatic track towards disarming Syria of its chemical weapons underway at the United Nations Security Council. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan, who negotiated the end of the war in Croatia and served with the UN in East Timor, joins us to discuss the wrangling between Russia, who is opposed to Chapter 7, and most of the permanent five, plus the UN Secretary General, who want to have the stick while offering the carrot. Then, following the latest gun massacre that followed a weekend in America in which 57 people were shot, we will look into how difficult it is to get mental health care while it is increasingly easy to get guns. Carolyn Reinach-Wolf, a partner in a law firm where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice, joins us to discuss the legal issues involved in protecting the rights of the mentally ill and how they can be balanced against the need to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill, given that the well-armed shooters behind the massacres at the Navy Yard, Virginia Tech, Aurora, and Sandy Hook all had mental health issues. Then finally, we'll examine the latest U.S. Census Bureau report on poverty in America with Stephen Pimper, the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, who is a professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work. We will discuss how, unlike most advanced democracies who are funding programs to end poverty, the United States House of Representatives has cut funds and is planning on cutting more to further impoverish and deny food to the 22% of the nation's children who go to bed hungry and the 15% of the population who live in poverty. And joining us now is Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan before being recalled over a conflict on how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. A former U.S. ambassador to Croatia in 1995, he was the co-mediator and principal architect of the agreement that ended the war in Croatia. And from 2000 to 2001, he served with the United Nations in East Timor. He's also a professor of national security strategy at the National War College and is currently a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. His books include Unintended Consequences, How the War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies, and The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Well, good to be with you.
And obviously, meetings are going on Tuesday in the Security Council at the United Nations, trying to hammer out how to proceed. Two things, of course, at least the shadow, I guess, that's hanging over the Russian position is the release of the UN report on who was responsible for the August 21st chemical weapons attack in Damascus. And it's pretty the evidence is overwhelming that it was a Syrian regime. And yet Foreign Minister Lavrov is saying we have serious reason to suggest that it was a provocation by the rebels. So are the Russians going to sort of drop that one, or did they just trap themselves into this situation?
I'm not sure that I can predict what the Russians will do, but if you pressed me, I would say that they are likely to keep on their line, but say it. With ever less conviction and ever more softly, because I think at this stage, after that UN report, they must realize that it is an extreme likelihood that it was the regime that used the weapons, not the rebels.
So in terms of the wrangling that's going on in the UN Security Council in these Tuesday meetings, the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, is basically saying that we need a Chapter 7 under the UN Charter. It's the most effective way to deal with threats to international peace and security. And in reality, we need clear guidelines under Chapter 7. The Russians are opposed to Chapter 7. Their compromise position is, well, if Assad reneges on the agreement, then maybe you can invoke Chapter 7, but they don't want it up front. So is this a deal breaker?
It shouldn't be a deal breaker. And in fact, I think that the importance of this issue could be overstated. First, let's look at what are the two sides really concerned about. The Russian concern is that if they put this into a binding Security Council resolution, which is what a Chapter 7 resolution is, that the Americans will use any breach to justify not only taking military, well, to to justify taking military action, and military action which could continue indefinitely or continue until Assad is overthrown. I think the Russians feel very burned by what happened in Libya, where they joined in authorizing use of force to protect the people of Benghazi, and NATO not only took action to protect Benghazi, but then continued its military campaign to overthrow Gaddafi, and then once Gaddafi was overthrown, the NATO strikes continued until he was tracked down and killed. So they are concerned that if they give the Americans an inch, the Americans will take a mile. Now, President Obama and the U.S. administration, they obviously want Syria's obligations to be mandatory. And also, from the American point of view, there's a certain amount of face to be saved, having been moving toward military strikes, then having this Russian initiative come up. They don't want their domestic critics to say, well, they were soft, and so they'd like to say, well, yes, it's a mandatory resolution. But the reality is that Syria is going to be very difficult to disarm Syria in the middle of a civil war, so that we can expect some of these weapons to be destroyed. Others will be inaccessible. We don't know whether the Syrians will cheat or not, but frankly, chemical weapons that are hidden away are basically unusable, because the moment you take them out and want to use them, if you have large numbers that you've hidden away and you're not in compliance, when you take them out to deploy them, everybody will see this with the intelligence resources that a number of countries now have, and that will be a justification for a strike. And if you take them out and use just one or two, it again would invite a military response without actually accomplishing any military purpose that you might want to use the chemical weapons for. So as a practical matter, Syria's chemical weapons will be unusable, whether it's a Chapter 7 resolution or Chapter 6.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan before being recalled over a conflict on how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Croatia and also served with the United Nations in East Timor. And his latest book is The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. But, of course, the agreement, which in many ways seemed to have gotten President Obama off the hook in terms of a very, very unlikely passage of the war resolution in the Congress and tremendous resistance from the American public, this deal obviously is, to that extent, is helpful for the administration. But on the other hand, neither the Russians nor the United States and its allies are in any way restrained from supplying their combatants on both sides. So that's what's extraordinary about this deal, is that it's in no ways bringing about peace. It's not ending a war. In fact, most of the 110,000, 120,000 people that have been killed so far have been killed by conventional weapons, and we're going to be pouring them in, and so are the Russians.
Yes. I mean, that is an extremely important point, which is that chemical weapons are horrific, but they have killed 1 or 2% of the people who have died in this war. And this war will be continuing. And to some degree, all the attention that has gone to the chemical weapons issue has diverted attention from the horrors of the war itself and from the necessity of finding some kind of solution. You're also right to say that this diplomatic agreement was a godsend for President Obama. He faced an absolute foreign policy fiasco, where he had asked for authority for Congress for military strikes that almost certainly was not going to be forthcoming, where the United States was looking like it was going to be acting alone. Not even the British were joining in. And in saying that the U.S. could act alone, President Obama was beginning to sound like George Bush 10 years before on the eve of the Iraq invasion. What instead, and furthermore, had we then gone ahead and acted, it's not clear it would have had any impact on Syria's use of chemical weapons. We couldn't actually strike the chemical weapons for fear that we would release the poison gas and kill more people. So the whole hope was that surgical strikes on Syrian targets would have some deterrence value. Instead, thanks to the Russians, and thanks also, I think, to President Obama's threats and to some rather skillful follow-up on what the Russians said, the United States has gotten much more. It has a promise from the Syrians to get rid of these weapons, a promise that will certainly compel the Syrians to get rid of at least some of the weapons. It is a promise that will make it impossible for the Syrians to actually use the weapons again without facing certain consequences. So what is in hand is something that should be much more effective in terms of preventing another use of these weapons than what might have been accomplished by a military strike.
So, Ambassador Galbraith, you've spent a lot of time in Iraqi Kurdistan, and Iraqi Kurdistan, of course, is sheltering a massive influx of refugees from Syria, Kurdish refugees, the al-Nusra Front, this group that the Saudis appear to have let in and seem to be getting the weapons and are the most effective fighting force, apparently, on the rebel side. And, of course, they essentially justify what the dictator Assad says, which is it's either me or the terrorists. So to that extent, they're a godsend to the Assad regime. I'm absolutely mystified why we weren't able to influence the Saudis into not letting all these jihadis in. But the long and the short of it is, the al-Nusra people apparently issued a fatwa against the Syrian Kurds as heretics, and they had to flee. So how do we – I mean, isn't that our main problem here in terms of taking sides, that the side that we've taken is so tainted, not that the other guy is nothing but a murderous monster?
Well, that is a problem. As this war has proceeded, the influence of Islamic extremists has increased on the opposition side, and of course the influence of moderates has correspondingly diminished. And on the government side, the government, which had actually come into office with some hope of being reformist in 2000 when the President Assad's father died, is now drenched in blood and is responsible for horrific crimes. And of course, having extremists on one side and crimes committed on the other makes it very difficult to find a political settlement. But the problem with the opposition is not just the extremists, although that is a serious problem. It is that even the moderate and democratic parts of the opposition have not been able to win any significant support from Syria's minorities. The demography of Syria is this: about 60% of the country are Sunni Arabs, but there are about 12% who are Alawites. This is a very secretive sect that uses elements of Christianity and Islam, and which is the sect of President Assad and of the top people in the military and the government, and which is considered by most Sunnis as being not Muslim or heretical. There are about 10% Christians who, like Christian minorities around the Middle East, tend to side with the people who are in power. And then about 10-12% Kurds who were brutally repressed by Assad, but who feel that the opposition, even the democratic opposition, has offered them nothing. And another 5% Druze, again, who are quite fearful of what will happen if there is a Sunni-dominated regime in Damascus. The Alawites fear that if the regime is overthrown, they'll become victims of genocide. And, of course, the more crimes that are committed by the Assad regime and by Alawite militia make that more likely. And the end result of all of this is that Assad probably has a sufficient base of support with the support of the Alawites and with the support of enough Sunnis who have benefited from the regime, and the neutrality of the Christians and Kurds and Druze, that he will not be overthrown, that he will be able to stay in office for the indefinite future. And on the other hand, though, he may not be able to win control over the entire country. So Syria is likely to look like Lebanon did all through that 15-year civil war.
And if he does lose Damascus, which of course may be the rationale for using those chemical weapons, that would be obviously a huge blow. And there is of course talk of a kind of rump Sunni state, which may well be landlocked, and the Alawites retreating to the coast. I talked the other day to Joshua Landis, a Syrian expert at the University of Oklahoma, who does a daily newsletter, Syria Comment, and he brought up a point which I thought was interesting, and given your experience in Afghanistan, I'm curious to get your response. He argued that in many ways American strategists have come to the conclusion that Afghanistan was a poison chalice, and that both the Carter and Reagan administration's proxy war bringing in the jihadis to hurt the Russians and eventually leading to them to withdraw was a mistake, and that we should have left Afghanistan in Russian hands, and that the same applies to Syria, that whatever, if the Russians win, as they seem to have played a weak hand very cleverly, while we've played a strong hand somewhat clumsily, they may end up with the poison chalice. Do you buy that theory?
No, I don't. This isn't the Cold War, and we certainly shouldn't want the Russians to end up with a poison chalice. If the people we backed in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union ended up being the people who attacked us on September 11th, and the last thing, and that didn't just disrupt the United States; it disrupted the entire world. And so the last thing we would want is some kind of terrorist reaction against the Russians. That will make for a much less stable world. So I think we all have an interest in finding a solution. Now, in terms of the future of Syria, yes, you could end up with an Alawite state along the coast, and that is almost certainly what would happen if the Assad regime were kicked out of Damascus. But I'm guessing that they will be able to hold on to enough of Damascus for the indefinite future. The Kurds in the northeast and northwest of Syria have already declared a region, and they want to have the same rights as their Kurdish brethren have in Iraq, which is to say almost complete autonomy. So the Syria that was created between the two world wars is already now disintegrating.
So what is there any other scenario between that end game and the current situation? I mean, I can't imagine these people who have suffered so many massacres and reprisals ever sitting down together, but you've been dealing with some difficult situations there, the Balkan Wars with Croatia and Serbia and Timor as well. So give us your sense in the last couple of minutes of how there could be an agreement between these two people who are murdering each other in the most bloodthirsty way.
I think it's extremely difficult. What made getting an agreement in the Balkans possible was the intervention of the United States. And what ended the Lebanese Civil War, which may be the closest parallel, was Syrian intervention. But there's no Syria to intervene in Syria, and frankly, there are no outside countries who can shape the destiny of what's going on. And that comes to another very important point. Syria really isn't a Russian client, and the Russians have very minimal influence there in terms of being able to... Yes, they were able to pressure the Assad regime to give up the chemical weapons to avoid an airstrike, but I don't think that they have the power to produce a political settlement. And frankly, the countries that are helping the opposition don't have a lot of influence on them either. I mean, what's the future of Syria is going to be determined by the events in Syria and by the balance of forces there. And unfortunately, there isn't a lot of common ground.
Well, Ambassador Galbraith, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, good talking with you, and I wish I had a more optimistic prognostication.
Well, no point in being Pollyanna-ish. It is what it is, and it's a very hideous situation. And I thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan before being recalled over a conflict on how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. A former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, in 1995, he was the co-mediator and principal architect of the agreement that ended the war in Croatia, and from 2000 to 2001 served with the United Nations in East Timor. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the paradox in America, how it is so difficult to get mental health treatment, but so easy to get guns.
That until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never